Well, thank you for inviting me, guys. What I'm going to talk to you about today is about social inequality and poverty, but from a slightly different perspective that maybe you are used to. And I'm going to try to do two things. First of all, link it to the tradition of neuroscience, and then also linking it to the tradition of the social sciences as well, talking about ethical problems and what we are challenged with when we talk about neuroscience of social inequality. In some way, if you want to go back into history, the neuroscience of poverty and social status started with the work of Krechevsky, who was a Russian Jewish psychologist who fled to Berkeley, and he stayed there, and he founded actually a line of work that basically explored the effects of the enrichment of the environment. You see, these guys have friends and toys and all the nice stuff. And these guys, the poor guys, right, are in a, they don't even see, you know, side of the cage. So, you know, very disadvantaged. And as you can see in a very rough representation, you have the cells, and the cells here, the brain cells, you know, are more robust, you know, branching out and, you know, interconnectivity. And that's the effect of what it was called at one point, the enriched environment effect. And later, very recently, it has been brought to the attention that virtually all these toys and all this environment has a dramatic effect on the brain of the animals that are studied, and you know they have a general plasticity effect in terms that the brain is more flexible, it's weird and efficient for tasks in visual, motor, cognitive, and somatosensory tasks. Now, as you can guess, right, I don't want to say that, we are animals, I don't want to simplify anything here, but, you know, we tend to do the same thing. You know, this is a Montessori classroom, this is another classroom. And you can see, you know, one is, there is some poverty here and, you know, enrichment of environment here. And the idea is, you know, the kids that are here, you know, will develop a learning experience and an educational experience which is richer, right? So there is an analogy there. Now, there is also this part of the equation, the stress. I mean, you don't want to mess with this guy, right? And you have to also to understand that the same individual can flip and flop, okay, through the phenotype transformation, through dominance, right? So this is a guy that has the territory, all the females, is, you know, really bully-like, and you don't want to even get near, you know, his territory because he will attack you, okay? But he's also under lots of stress, and the non-dominant is also under a lot of stress because it's socially controlled by the 5% of the territorial males. So this is another model of the stress mediating the effects of poverty or socioeconomic status, which also has roots in this wonderful study. This series of study was done by Fernald in Stanford, and he has many papers. You should see it's a fantastic work. Now, the question is, as long as you want to push the envelope and the analogy, it's not easy to define the problem of socioeconomic status and poverty in humans. There are many things to consider. So if you want to measure the socioeconomic status or the level of poverty, you can have different approaches. And one approach is, for example, an absolute indicator, like it could be income, right? But then you could have also relative poverty in a country like Canada or the United States, because if you measure low socioeconomic status in a ratio, okay, so the income but also what you can buy with it, right, then it becomes different, right? So if you earn $1 million, okay, and the loaf of bread costs $2 million, you are not very rich, right? Now, that's a paradox that is, you know, comes and goes in the literature, but you also have other paradoxes. So usually research uses polarities. It uses high socioeconomic status, low socioeconomic status, poverty versus, you know, middle socioeconomic status. And this is called the extreme group approach, according to which poverty is just a cutoff. Okay, you have an arbitrary cutoff, and for example, the government in Canada decides that you are poor according to the villages or city you live if you earn less than $30,000 a year. Okay, this is Statistics Canada. Now, in another approach, which I will basically talk about, we talk about gradient. So in a distribution, okay, you will have, you know, people that are well off, people that are, you know, are in the lower side of the distribution, okay, and poverty is just the extreme values, okay, on the lower side of the socioeconomic status, however you measure it. Okay, so poverty is a special case, extreme case of lower SES socioeconomic status. And I will basically talk about poverty and low SES in the same terms. I will just distinguish when it's needed. Now, what do we know about research at the psychological level, also neuropsychological level, behavioral neuroscience? Well, what happens is on any behavioral indicator and on any field, mental health, education, language, cognition, if you take children from a sample and a population of low SES and high SES, you will see that low SES are outperformed. They don't perform as well as the high SES. And this has been, for example, has gone on for many, many years since the 60s with intelligence scores and IQ scores. And, you know, some have also talked about syndrome of poverty. So there is such a cluster of negative outcomes around poverty or low SES, which people think it's a syndrome. And apparently, so when you meet a low SES individual, you may infer that that person, you know, has bad health, you know, has bad education, and so you tend to generalize the individual to the category that has this syndrome. And this is important for what I'm going to talk later on. So, what is known behaviorally? We have done probably 50 years of research at the level of behavioral outcomes. Well, we know that the disadvantage in low SES and poor children is, you know, on many, many fields, but these are essentially the fields that are actually more compromised. Language, executive functions, so the function to control cognitively the actions and to multitasking or control what is called the working memory, so taking information and managing information while you're taking it in. Attention and stress. So people that have low SES or live in poverty have an higher level of the stress hormone cortisol. And this has been replicated many, many times, although in children, that's a more variable result. Now, why would we use neuroimaging then? We have done 50 years of research, right? You can tell, Amedeo, you are wasting our time. I could be, you know, listening to good jazz or, you know, or drumming or doing stuff. Why are you, you know, even telling it this? Well, basically, okay, beyond what I've written there, okay, what I really think is that behavior is not that strong of an indicator. Okay, so you know, right now, you know, you could imagine something else, and I couldn't tell from the behavior, right? You could be sleeping, you could be thinking about, you know, the television that you may be watching this night, tonight, but I cannot tell, right? Now, if I had something, okay, that can tell me something about the brain activity, okay, then it's different, because then I can relate your emotional state, I can relate your cognitive state, okay, that I cannot easily observe, to an indicator that is objective and that is linked to parts of the brain that we know are related to what you know are doing. And in fact, there are many, many problems that we could actually tackle, you know, with neuroimaging related to the socioeconomic conditions. We could look at if, for example, cognitive neuroscience, the branch of neuroscience that uses neuroimaging, can solve some of the problems, right? For example, tell us plastic change in the brain, exactly as we have, you know, sort of hinted at in the first slide, where we have seen the cages that change the plasticity and the synaptic activity of the brain. And, you know, if that change with interventions, programs that help these children are then retained, okay, are permanent. And not to depress you, but the problem is not... Now, this is an old one. I cannot tell you what the millions of children are, because ARPER just single-handedly, you know, took off the census. So we don't actually know how many kids are living in poverty. But for example, the US have better statistics right now, and 17%, it was about 2 years ago. Now, 2 years ago, the economic downturn and the economic damage wasn't at its peak, right? We know now that it's actually continuing, that it's more severe. So you can imagine what the damage is. Now, an example of how you could actually approach problems with neuroimaging. These are images from one of the techniques that is most used right now. It's called the functional magnetic resonance imaging, and it's actually picking up oxygen and blood activity when children are doing a phonological task. So they are deciding about the rules, the phonological, the sound that are embedded in the words. Now, normally, okay, what you are looking at is there is a difference, okay, that you also see in the size, okay, between the left and the right part of the language areas, right? Can you see me, or I'm overshadowing the image? Can you see? Can you follow? Right. Okay. So, what this guy, and basically you can see that change and proficiency in phonological and language tasks goes hand in hand with the differences between these two parts of the brain. Now, if you correlate that difference, okay, in that part of the brain with the socioeconomic rank of the individuals, you'll see what is called the gradient. Right? So the higher the SES, okay, the better these kids are, actually more differences between the left and the right they have, indicating that the area that the left part of the brain is more specialized and therefore more efficient in processing, in understanding and elaborating language information and phonology. Now, this happens. So when you have just the correlation, right, the association between just those two that I've shown you, okay, you see there is a, you know, a large effect. Now, if you, in technical term, is called partial out. So you basically take the variance, okay, take the amount of data, okay, that will be explained, okay, by, for example, other variables out of this association or relationship, okay, you can still see, okay, that even if you basically partial out, so exclude all the effects or influence of these other variables, is still a strong effect. And so there is still a strong, genuine relationship between language skills and socioeconomic status as reflected by neuroimaging. Isn't that nice? Well, it's not nice, but I mean, it's nice that you have a something, okay, objective that can allow you to pinpoint these things. Now, I don't use fMRI because I'm poor. And I accept donations, MasterCard, Visas, everything, okay, tonight. It's shameless self, okay, anyway. I actually use a technique that I like more than fMRIs. So, you know, we put a cap, you know, comfortable, you know, the kids like it, and the cap has embedded electrodes, and we just, you know, pick up the electrical activity from the scalp. And not only that, we can take it for hours. Well, we wouldn't do that to the children. But we have tasks like, you know, a phonological task, for example. And we can pinpoint, okay, the timing and what's happening in that particular activity while they are doing the task with brain waves. Okay, that are called event-related potentials. And for example, so we have done a study where we had selected very carefully two groups of children, okay, and we wanted to study, okay, their ability to selectively attend information while ignore other information. So central their information, focusing their information on important things versus filter out things that were not important. And this is selective attention task. The task was just an auditory task where we had tones of different frequencies and different characteristics, and they had to pick the right one between, you know, among a bunch of other distractors. And now what is interesting, so our sample came from a semi-rural part of British Columbia, and a river runs through it, so we had the lowest ES children, the poorest neighborhood here at this part, and then the other one was instead the people that were living in a affluent neighborhood. Now, what I should say is that there was a marked differences between the places and the environments where these kids were living. So these kids, for example, would have to walk to school for kilometers, and there would be prostitutes and things going on. Instead, in this other place, you could leave a car with the keys in it, and people would return it. Okay? So, not to say that there was a difference in morality. I don't care about morality. But I'm saying the one place it was full of danger and threatening stuff for these kids. The other one was a relatively more safer environment. And what happens is the two children really differed for the fact that they were living in these two different environments. All other aspects were pretty much comparable, except that the children, of course, as you could imagine, were outperformed in the evaluation, the school evaluations, the provincial exams. But most of them wouldn't even show up for them. So now, and we also had measures of accuracy of their performance. So they had to press a button when they actually got the right tone. And as you can see, if anything, the low SES were slightly better, but there is no difference really statistically. And we had a good power, and also the statistics was sound. So it was a robust behavioral study where there were no differences between the two groups. The two groups were equal regarding the particular task. However, when you look at the waves, and these are ERPs, okay, so you have the attended are the yellow one, okay, and the unattended stimuli, the irrelevant stimuli, are the blue one. Just a a note. So this is standard in the cognitive neuroscience in terms of understanding, okay, what's going on in emotional state or cognitive state. You have two different conditions. In this particular one, you have attended stimulus and unattended stimulus. And then the differential here is what is really important, right? You could have also a baseline where they don't do anything and they do other things, and you would see a differential in the waves. If you see the differential, it means that the two states in those two different situations are different, right? And what you can see is, for the in the ISCS kids, okay, you see a major difference. This difference is then computed in this way, and these lines are actually telling you that if these lines are out of these boundaries, okay, there is a very significant, very important effect. If not, they are not. And so what you can see is that in at least two key parts that are known in the human processing in the brain, these children have a difference between attended and unattended, versus you don't see this in the low SES, which means the low SES do have the same behavior, performing the same way, but they seem not to discriminate attended important information from unimportant information. They are attending to everything. How do you know that? Well, another analysis can use actually the energy. So the total amount of energy used by the brain and the electrical activity, and you will see that the low SES children, okay, put a lot of work, okay, their EEG is off the roof, and especially for the irrelevant stimuli. They are attending most of the time to the distractors, not the targets. Now, this is another depiction of that, and you can see that the effect is pretty much all over the frontal and the central. And this actually is called the frontotemporal, and is corresponds loosely to an area which is called the prefrontal cortex. And the prefrontal cortex is key in controlling your actions and your emotions and regulating your action appropriately in terms that it's adequate for the demands of the task and the environment. Now, what is really, really nice about this also is that we also collected cortisol. So we collected saliva, and we actually analyzed cortisol. And what you can see is pre-test, before the test, we collected cortisol, okay? And you can see that there is still the relationship between the white dots are individual SES rank, so there is a gradient with the differences in EEG activity, okay, that I've just shown. So basically, these are basically the difference. The points are the differences between these, right? And so you can see that as the kids have higher SES, okay, they actually perform better because they are actually attending more selectively, right? At the same time, however, the cortisol goes down as the SES goes up, okay? And there is an inverse relationship, okay, between the two, meaning that the efficiency of the EEGs or the performance, okay, is directly, okay, increases with SES. So increases as the SES increases, but decreases with cortisol. And we knew that lower SES kids had more cortisol. So that means that at onset, the pattern of activity points at stress or an aversive pattern reaction to the task. And in fact, we also took self-reports through questionnaires of how they felt. And boredom in low SES was actually accounting for an enormous amount of the data. Now, how is stress related to boredom? Well, there are lots of experiments in monkeys that show when monkeys, and especially in zoos, and you can go in zoos and see that, when monkeys are extremely stressed, they actually display boredom and they feel like they are bored. Okay? They actually do display the same grooming or the same relationship patterns with the others as when they are bored. Now, another thing that we found, and this is another study, was a difference between the left and right activation. So in the ISES group, you see a lower a percentage of people that would maximally respond in the right part of the cortex. Most of them will actually use the left part, right? In the low ACS, it's the opposite. And there is a relationship between the cortisol release and the activation of the right hemisphere, which, you know, most of the time indicates an aversive response. This is the same information. So if it's positive, the right brain is actually more activated. And if it's negative, it's the left brain. And this is a metric, more precise measurement of the level of activation of the brain, instead of just saying how many people were showing one pattern versus the other. Are you okay so far? Are we good? All right. Now, I can do the same thing as fMRI with EEGs, and cheaper. Right, I can show activation. This is one study that my friend Kishiyama has done at Berkeley. He has sent me this for this talk. Thank you so much. And so what happens is, if you see the difference of activation, okay, when they are attending in a similar task, is a visual task though, you can see more activity here, okay, for the kids. There are ISES, but none of that there. And usually that is called hypoactivity, and it's, you know, related to something of a deficit, right? A deficitary performance, or, you know, not optimal. So, knowing what we know, okay. Knowing about the cages, you know, the enriching environment, and, you know, you name it, one could think, why don't we devise interventions for kids and to help them work more efficiently, cognitively and behaviorally and what have you. And this is actually taken from Parent Canada, where there was an issue, and this is the representation of how to intervene and make the children smarter. And in fact, you know, it's a very good opportunity to do things. There are many programs. These are some of the best known programs in the U.S. Where it seems that they are working and they have a nice effect. However, there is no real testing using neuroimaging. So there is no clinical trials, no real evaluation of this on how and if these interventions change the brain, right? The other interesting thing is that you see an increase, for example, in intelligence scores in the interventions. But then, if you don't keep it up for a few months, they go down. And what is also interesting is that in the long-term period, okay, you will see benefits of these interventions, but in adults, not in the children. Okay, and you will see it, 20 or maybe 30 years. And this is an interesting thing. Okay, what happens when there is the fade out period? Okay, because they seem the same, but we don't know, right? Because behaviorally, they seem the same. But what happens in the brain, nobody knows. I'm trying to do a study, but nobody knows yet. So we can go beyond the behavior, right? With cognitive neuroscience, with these techniques, we can actually look into how the mechanism works, and we can do a better job than lie detection for most of the time, right? Because we are actually relating information that we know are behaviorally meaningful and to performance. And so, you know, there are lots of problems for students and people that want to get into this field and work on socioeconomic status, right? So at this point, I would end the talk here, right? And we would be okay, and, you know, science has triumphed, and everybody goes home, okay, we have the solution, well, hey, Hollywood, right? Now, no. There are many, many problems that stay with neuroimaging that actually have to be dealt with when actually we want to intervene on children, and the debate has not even started. So we have these pretty images that I've showed you, right? I can explain things, and then I say, oh, there is a deficit. These kids are not, you know. But how do you define the deficit? Okay, in the study that I just showed you, okay, there was no performance difference. There was a difference in the brain, but a difference is a difference. It's not a deficit, okay? But the field is moving that way, right? And there is a lot of what we call deficit attribution in the literature. So the assumption that a difference in the brain in the two groups should be interpreted as a deficit in lower RCS children. And okay, you know, there are many problems. I've already told you the general gist. You have the general gist of what the problems are in interpreting the behaviors. There are also other differences in terms of how the deficits are actually defined. Okay, so what is the group that does better? The ISES, the rich kids or the middle SES kids, right? But why are they the norm? Right? Why are they the good ones that we have to have as the reference point? Because that's what the point, I mean, that's what happens, right? And I can show you that it's not, in, you know, I don't want to show you this. We can discuss about this. But I want to show you. Okay, so this is a very, very influential review of the field, right? And these guys are saying, even when performance differences do not emerge between lower and higher SES individuals, there are differences in the degree to which specific neural systems are recruited. What does that mean? And so, you have not shown a lesion. You have not shown a real deficit in the brain. You have shown differences. So you cannot infer differences are deficits. And in fact, they go on and they're, oh, wait, we need to intervene on the kids. We need to, you know, do these interventions because they get better, right? We know that they get better. You know, they improve. Marvelous. Now, this is from a paper that has been collecting testimonials for people that work in the neuroscience field, in the clinical neuroscience field, but it's a similar situation with these images, you know, the nice fMRI things, and I don't want to bother you, but essentially what the quote says is, we don't know anything about the neuroimaging yet, right? And so we cannot tell to the parents what is not really, okay, that we don't know. I mean, so you couldn't report to the parents that because there is a difference, okay, the kids are in trouble, because it's not true. Okay, in my experiments, they perform as well as the IRCS. And this is a major topic in the neuroscience, in neuroethics. In the next decade, this will be the problem. Okay, this will be a major problem, because now neuroscience is pitching groups against groups, right? There are, you know, ethnic groups, there are groups that, you know, have leadership, you name it. Studies are coming out every day, right? And this is the problem, okay? Differences don't always say, you know, that there are, you know, negative or, you know, better things in groups anyway. They only show differences of patterns of activation. There are also other things. There are also many studies that show that the late bloomers actually in the long run perform better, okay, in the schools and in the school programs. And in fact, that is one of the points that has been used to push Montessori education, because at every single test that is done longitudinally, okay, these kids don't do well initially and then outperform any other kids, okay? But they use their own pace to go through the material and learn, okay? And so it has been proven again and again that the late blooming effect is very robust, and it shows actually that plasticity in the brain takes its time, and the later actually you use some of the circuitry, you actually become more efficient. Okay, there are also other considerations about what is that the normative difference between high and low SES is, and what is the expectation of the children that are in the low SES category. Okay, what is the group of reference, the middle class group that is the, you know, the mainstream? And the other thing is, when you talk to enthusiasts of interventions, it seems that everything works, okay? So you have to intervene on the kids, you know, the poor kids, and because everything works. But the thing is, there are differences in what you are intervening, right? And the intensity of the intervention. And also, you cannot always put in correspondence the interventions that you do behaviorally with changes in the brain, because we don't have the studies. No one has done the studies. So an intervention targeting behavior, it's not necessarily an intervention that has an impact on the brain. Okay, we have not studied that. Now, another thing is this. Why is that poor or low SES kids are the target by default of these interventions? Okay, why higher SES kids are not targeted? And I'm asking this question because now we know that there is a lot of risk also in higher SES kids. Higher SES kids are 2 or 3 times more likely to be in trouble with drugs and psychopathology than lower SES kids, especially in adolescents. But we don't target them, right? It doesn't seem right. You know, we have to target the lower SES kids because they have the problem. Come on. We have not shown the problem, but we target them anyway. Now, the other thing is that there is this generalization about what a poor person or a lower SES person is. And, you know, this comes pretty much in consideration when you actually see television, okay? What is the prototype of the lower SES working class person? The Simpsons, right? Right? So they are losers, pathetic losers. They are not, they don't perform well. They are incompetent, right? And they cannot provide for themselves, right? And this is actually put into full view when you actually look at some of the papers that actually report on neurocognitive studies. One of these reports went as far as making the analogy between the performance of poor kids and stroke patients. Right? So the performance of the children was similar, in their view, to stroke patients. But in reality, I mean, these are two very different things. Okay, they cannot be equated. Where am I in time? Right, 15 minutes,
yeah? Yeah, but we want to ask a question.
All right, oh, I've taken all this time? Okay. So, basically, I mean, I'm saying, you know, for me, the agenda is to actually overturn some of the myths and use science for what it is, instead of propagating, you know, opinions that are not based on anything. So it is a very important work. And I have to tell you something. The intervention started in Italy, in Florence. Okay, this is the Ospedale degli Innocenti was built actually by Brunelleschi, and it was a place where if children had needed, okay, had actually a shelter, okay, newborns could be left at the door. And it's the same thing that happened 2 years ago in Vancouver, where they had this cradle that could recess, you know, in a door. So some of the people that couldn't take care of, of their own kids and they were poor off or other conditions would leave the newborns, and the city would take care of them. And in fact, you know, if you look at this painting, okay, these are the kids that are left behind. Okay, these are the politicians, right? And these are the schools, and there's an entire, now this is the detail, the larger picture is very, very interesting because it really, really tells you what we are doing now. But they were doing it already, you know, a while back, right? But I don't think that we have progressed so much. And instead the progression maybe should be theoretically, you know, epistemological. It should be something to think about how we interpret data and, you know, be more careful with it. Thank you so much.